part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
All right, let's get started. This is Part-Time Fanboy. And that was a very aggressive opening. My name is Christian Horn, and I am here with two returning part-time fan people, Corey Blake and Liad Goldberg. And the reason we are here, well, there was a movie that opened this weekend called Deadpool. You haven't seen it yet, right, Corey?
I have not.
But Liad and I saw it, and I could just say that it was, I thought it was great, right, Liad? Like, it was really fun. Like, we'll just say that.
Yeah.
But we're not here. Yeah.
Spoiler free review.
Yeah, we're not gonna spoil it for you, Corey. What we're actually here to talk about, and it's actually related to Deadpool, because excuse me, Deadpool, he was a member of X-Force, right? Or something like that.
He was like a villain.
A villain.
And eventually he was a member, actually. That's true, too. Yeah.
Yeah. So but he started off as a bad guy or something like that. Or right. Just kind of a pain, like a mercenary. But anyway, yeah. He's tangentially related to the X books. And our friend Corey has taken it upon himself to read all of the X-Men books from issue one onward. And you've been doing this for how long, Corey?
I think I started last year.
Okay.
I mean, I'm going slowly. It's not like I'm reading, you know, five books a day or anything like that. So I'll do chunks, you know, usually on the weekend or something like that. But it's something like maybe a year.
Yeah. But Corey's been posting like little summations of his thoughts on what he's been reading for like the past year on his Facebook page. And I just found them, I always find them really interesting because I was a big X-Men fan back in the day. I mean, I still kind of am. I don't read the comics, but there's still a soft place in my heart. And so whenever I read your updates, I'm always like, oh, I would just love to talk about X-Men with you because I don't think I read a lot of that Silver Age stuff. I mean, I have gone back and read some of the early issues, but it would just be, I always thought it would be really fun to have a conversation about the X-Men with you because, and now since Deadpool is out this weekend and he's sort of related to the X-Men, there are X-Men in the Deadpool movie, or at least one, which I was happy to see.
Technically two.
Is Warhead, Teenage Warhead, is she an X-Men?
Technically.
Was she?
She was in a book at one point, like, basically a throwaway character. I don't even know what her powers were in the book, if I remember correctly. And she was a student, like, in the movie.
Yeah.
And that was it. Very, very much a, like, not a big character, if I remember correctly.
Gotcha.
But
she like dropped the mail off at the mansion one day, and that's you're good enough for the next
something yeah. like that.
I was just wondering if she was who was it? Who's the guy that wrote, created the Zorn like stuff?
Grant Morrison.
Is she a Grant Morrison creation?
90%.
Yeah, I think she was. Anyway, so Deadpool's tangentially connected to the X-Men. Corey's been reading the X-Men books for a year. And he probably knows more about the X-Men right now than I do. And I just figured it would be an interesting podcast to sit down with Corey, the man who reads X-Men, and just chat about it. So Corey, were you and Liad's an X-Men fan, and
yes.
He's a Deadpool fan, so Liad wanted to join in, and right. It's been so long since we've gotten several of you, both of you guys on, so I figured let's just do this. There you go. There's the explanation. The overly long explanation for this episode for any listeners.
I think we've justified our this episode.
Yeah, I think so. But so, Corey, why the X-Men? Why not Fantastic Four, Captain America, any other group? Why the X-Men for you?
I think I picked them. I mean, I actually want to do this same thing on those books as well. But I think I picked X-Men first because, like you, it was, you know, when I was younger, when I first started reading comics, it wasn't the very first comic that I read, but it was probably the one that I got into the most once I did start reading. You know, I guess I would say after New Warriors, but New Warriors was never a, like a, you know, full on franchise. I mean, at one point they had three books, but, you know, including spinoffs, but the X-Men of course has sort of been around for quite a while and is quite the empire. And so I really got into them, really in the '90s, I think I was telling you on Facebook. And I was always, I had read some reprints and I had read some stuff previous to when I started reading. And I had always known that there was this, you know, everybody kind of knows the story, well, not everybody, but most people know the story about the book was made in the 60s by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. It did okay, you know, kind of petered along and then got canceled and then came back in the mid 70s. And that's when it really took off. And that's, I think for most people, when they really started paying attention to it and, you know, it's almost like everything before then is almost forgotten. Aside from, you know, maybe the first issue, I suppose. So I've always been curious, like, what happened between issue one, which I read through reprints, and all the stuff before the big Chris Claremont relaunch, although he didn't technically do the relaunch, but, you know, he took over pretty quickly right after, and obviously became quite identified with the book after that. And then, of course, there's all this stuff from before I started reading in the 90s that I was always curious about. Some of it I'd read, some of it I hadn't, or I'd read summaries of or something like that. And so I was just curious, like, you know, I want to fill those gaps in my head about how the characters got from First Day at the Mansion for Jean Grey in 1963 to, you know, now, really. So that's why I picked them, is because I have that affection for the characters, even though, like you, I haven't actually been reading them for a few years now, actually. But my idea is to read Uncanny X-Men from start to finish before, you know, not counting, you know, up to issue 600. And then it gets relaunched and some other things happen. And I may or may not read it after that.
Well, here's the thing. You're going to... if you're not doing any of the spin-off titles or like X-Men or whatever, you're going to have that. That's going to be a hard read, don't you think? After a while, you're going to be like, what's going on?
Yeah. I haven't quite figured out how thorough I'm going to be. Like during the the little gap where they were canceled, they had some appearances. And so I read some of those. So I've already kind of opened the doorway of I'm obviously reading stuff beyond just Uncanny X-Men. So obviously there's crossovers and things that I'm sure I'm gonna read, and I'm reading these through Marvel's the Marvel Unlimited digital library or whatever that subscription
the app,
service.
Right?
Yeah, the app, not the Comixology thing, but like the, you know, you subscribe to it and you just get the whole library. And
how do you find that thing? Because I haven't signed up for it and I've been debating on whether I should.
I like it. I like it a lot. It's nice to just be able to not have to debate, like, do I want to spend $1.99 on this issue? Like, it's just it's just paid for and I can just read whatever I want. So I like it a lot.
And how much is it? It's like 10 bucks a month or something?
I think maybe a little lower than that, actually.
Yeah.
Depending on how you do it, you know, like if you pay for the whole year or if you do 6 months or, you know, however you do it. But it's something like that.
Yeah, the thing that kept me from signing on is my PC is like a tablet PC. And Windows, the App Store sucks, and they don't have the Marvel app. And I was just like, you got to be kidding me with this, you know? But I have an Android phone, and I've been thinking about buying like a cheap Android app, Android tablet to just read comics on. You know what I mean? Have a reader. So I've been thinking about signing up for that. So when. And I'm going to ask Leah this question too. Do you remember your first X-Men book, like in continuity, like of your teenage years, like not with, through the Marvel app, but do you remember which particular issue or which sort of creative team? I mean, it must have been Chris Claremont, but like as far as the artists go,
do you remember? I'm you know, pretty confident that my first X-Men issue. Oh, actually. I'm going to change my answer at the last minute. I don't remember the exact number, but it was Uncanny X-Men Annual number 15 or something. It was it's crossed over with the New Warriors, and that's how I got into the whole.
Oh.
They scammed me. It worked.
Marvel's good at that.
Yeah, so I picked up the New Warriors annual. It was part two of the Kings of Pain crossover. The last New Mutants annual was part one, so I went and got that. And then it, of course, continued into Uncanny X-Men and then X-Factor. And then I read those four, really was intrigued. And then at that time, the whole X-Men, you know, X-Men, like the new X-Men number one with Jim Lee was coming out. And so that was my first probably, you know, like regular issue. I got that. And then the Uncanny X-Men 281, I think. And then from there, you know, that was it.
Wow. Yeah, you were late to the game, like the Jim Lee stuff. That's great.
Oh,
yeah.
I was even later to the game.
Oh, really? When did you start,
Leon? I do not have such a good memory, so I honestly can't say exactly. Not like Corey. I got into things through Spider-Man. Spider-Man was always my gateway into comics and everything comic related. I remember something about Cable, reading a Cable book way back when. Yeah, but then I didn't really, really get into it until I think Joe Mad was doing the artwork.
Oh, wow.
So
that is later in the
game. Yeah, way later. But then I did a lot of backtracking. I have a lot of the... before that, I bought a lot of trades and collections and stuff. So I went back and backtracked and did a, you know, not the most comprehensive, but a little bit comprehensive reading. But yeah, I got into it way late because, like I said, Spider-Man was my way in. So
gotcha. Yeah, for me, I think I'm a little earlier than you guys, way earlier than you guys. I started getting in during the Paul Smith years, and I think that the first couple of issues were during that stretch. I remember that there was the first big issue that I remember is, I think it's, I can't remember the number, but it is an issue where it's like an anniversary issue. I don't think it's an annual. And it is where Cyclops and the X-Men think that Jean Grey has been like resurrected or something. And it's Mastermind kind of messing with them. They're trying to figure out if Madeline Pryor is like a reincarnation of like Dark Phoenix or something. Mm-hmm. And everyone has to sort of figure out like what they're going to do. And it ends up being... Mastermind sort of turns all the other X-Men against Cyclops, and he has to sort of like run the gamut against them, and he kind of like is able to defeat them all with his knowledge of the X-Mansion and all that. And I remember the art just like sucking me in, and then just being like, who are these characters? And it was definitely during the Paul Smith era where I was kind of like dipping my toes in. But then obviously, there was Dark Phoenix, right? So I was like, what is this Dark Phoenix thing? Like, I don't even know. And at that time, at my comic shop, they had the trade, the John Byrne trade, the first collection, which I still have in my possession. It's a little beat up, but and I've bought these over again in years. But that was sort of my first sort of big exposure to John Byrne, which it may have been that or Alpha Flight. I think they were both coming out at the... But that was like when I started becoming a huge John Byrne fan. I loved him. And that Dark Phoenix thing just blew my mind. The original Chris Claremont, like, just blew my teenage mind. I was like, what is this? Like, who are these crazy people? And Disco and, like, the Hellfire Club and, like, Dazzler. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like... It was great. And it was just... That Dark Phoenix saga really is like an amazing introduction to the X-Men, you know, where it just sort of gives you everything you need, even though it doesn't explain everything, right?
Right.
Yeah, well, especially the kind of epilogue with the funeral, that really gives you a whole recap of everything. So
yeah.
So yeah, I mean that's really considered, and I think rightly so, the pinnacle of the book, and it really, you know. It's interesting. I've been reading online, sort of background stuff, you know, like reading about the the little behind the scenes shenanigans, and you know, you really get the impression that Chris Claremont and John Byrne were really button heads, especially yeah. towards the end, of course, and so. But you know, it's like one of those things where it's, even though they disagreed, there was a chemistry with the two of them where they were pulling each other in just the right way that it produced something really, really fun and fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that seems to be the era that every other book in going down, like every other storyline, just like really pulled from that and Days yeah. of Future Past. You know.
Yeah. Those two, yeah, absolutely.
But the one thing I wanted to ask you, Corey, or the one thing that I've wanted to discuss in, you know, your write-ups and stuff is, I mean, reading the Silver Age stuff, because I've gone back and read a lot of Silver Age comics, and I find them, a lot of them, to be actually really entertaining, probably more so than when I was younger going back reading mm-hmm. Silver Age comics, because I think I really wasn't appreciative of the art with a lot of Silver Age books. There was something that didn't click with me. And you know, I'll admit it now, like Jack Kirby, when I was younger, there was something that I just didn't enjoy about his artwork, although oh. I grew to appreciate. What?
Oh,
are
yeah.
you going to trash no. Jack Kirby now, Leo?
No, don't no, trash I'm going to do the exact opposite. I love Jack Kirby.
Me too.
But when I was a kid, I could not stand
yeah,
his artwork.
There's something about
but
it.
I grew, the more you get into it, the more mature you get. You see how amazing his artwork really is. But yes, the style, I think, is what never spoke to me as a kid.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, now as an adult, like you said, going back and looking at a lot of Silver Age stuff, like my brother-in-law, as a present a while ago, sent me like some early Captain America stuff. And I was reading it, and I was just like, oh my God, this stuff is crazy. Like, it's so much fun. There's, like, so much stuff in here. You know what I mean? What is your, Corey, what's your take on the early stuff? Because that must have been the most eye-opening for you, right? Or at least...
Yeah, it really was. You know, that was kind of like one of the driving forces for wanting to start with the X-Men is because I really wanted to find out what happened in those years that were so rarely referenced. And so, you know, the first issue I think is totally solid. Like, I think it's a fantastic first issue.
Yeah.
Like, it lays down the premise, lays down all the major players. You get the villain who's going to be the recurring villain for a long time, forever, basically. You understand the dynamics, the concept of the mutants. I mean, it's really like when I reread it, and I had read it previously, but when I reread it, I really appreciated how good of a first issue it is.
Yeah. Wait. So before we keep going, we haven't even explained the premise of the X-Men. Since you're talking about the first issue, I mean, I'm sure there's people listening to this who are like, I know what the X-Men, but maybe there aren't. So what is the premise of the X-Men, Corey?
The X-Men sounds ridiculous to even have to explain it, but you're right. It could be something. It's like, you know, Superman is a character who...
you never know.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. So the X-Men revolves around a school that secretly houses a super team, a superhero team of mutants. And mutants, as in this universe, as this book depicts, are characters who are born with powers. They have this strange genetic quirk that gives them abilities. So as Stanley likes to joke, it was kind of his cheat on having to come up with different origins for everybody. They were just born that way. So the school is run by Professor Charles Xavier, who is a handicapped. He's in a wheelchair. He's wheelchair bound, older guy, and he's a telepath, and he's kind of the headmaster of the school, runs the school, and then this team consists of his students. Who are Cyclops, who we've mentioned, Scott Summers, who should shoot a beam from his eye, the Angel, Warren Worthington III, who has wings,
yeah.
flight, the Beast, Hank McCoy, he has larger hands and feet and is very athletic and also very smart, and Iceman, Bobby Drake, who, just like the name sounds, you can control ice, make things cold and form ice, and Jean Grey, who is called Marvel Girl at first, and she has telekinesis, which allows her to move objects with her mind.
Yeah, and those are the beginning. That's the first issue. Like that is the foundation of the X-Men,
right.
All these characters. Yeah, yeah.
And they initially run into Magneto, who is kind of their main villain, and he can control metal with his mind, and he is determined to rule Earth because he believes that mutants should be superior, that they should be in charge.
Yeah, because they have powers, and they can just reign over humanity. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And so Professor X believes that it should be peaceful coexistence. And so what's really interested me, too, about that aspect of the book is that Chris Claremont really brought that to the front and really made that the overriding kind of a theme about civil rights and a lot of themes that can translate into either alienation as teenagers, but also, LGBT and you know, race issues and things like that. But the way that it was originally depicted, while you could definitely interpret it on that level, it was definitely not the focus.
That's always what I've wondered, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, because you've been reading every issue, and I always felt like there was always a bit of like Stan Lee revisionist history, where he's always talking about like, this guy was, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King, and this guy was Malcolm X, and you know, they blah blah blah, and I'm like, yeah, I remember reading some of those early issues, and like that sort of like mutants take over the world thing was there, but it didn't seem like it was that heavily rooted. Like, what is your opinion on that sort of thing? Like,
I think at times it is there. Like, there's a three-part Sentinel story that's sort of the last of Jack, you know, it's kind of pretty much ends Jack Kirby's run on the book. And it's great. It's great fun. And it's really good. It's the first Sentinel story, and Magneto's not in it at all. So I kind of disagree with that aspect of it. Obviously, I'll get to that a little bit later, but that is definitely the driving point. Like, the Sentinels are created because mutants are dangerous, so they need to be, you know, rounded up, basically. And so, but then you have, you know, issues upon issues where it's not even an issue. I mean, they're basically just a conventional superhero team.
Yeah.
So it kind of depends on which issues you're looking at. You know, it's like occasionally, you know, I don't know if Stanley kind of forgot about the theme occasionally, or he just felt like he didn't want to belabor it, which I can understand. You know, being in the 60s like that, it might be a little bit too much of a, you know, those were heightened times, and so he maybe felt like that's a little too controversial.
And it was a book for kids. Really, let's not forget that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. Teenagers,
exactly.
And stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was lightly touched on.
Yeah.
But you know, Magneto is played pretty much like a Dr. Doom, probably even more of a lunatic, you know, than Dr. Doom, as far as like just you know, I mean, he's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And a terrorist, straight up terrorist. And so to compare him to Malcolm X, I think is a little, you know, bordering on inappropriate.
I mean,
obviously he's a controversial figure, but I think he certainly did not go to the lengths that Magneto went to.
Yeah.
But one of the things that was interesting to me was that in those earlier days, particularly the Stanley Jack Kirby run, which ran for about, you know, a dozen or so issues, and then Stanley stayed on for a while, but then he eventually moved on. But during that sort of first, you know, well, not year, because it was a bi-monthly book at first, but, you know, 13 or 14 issues, how much of a recurring villain Magneto and his Brotherhood of Evil Mutants was.
Oh, really?
Like it really felt like, to me, it kind of felt like a precursor for like cartoons that would later come. You know, like G.I. Joe, when you look at G.I. Joe or something like that, it's like Cobra apparently is the only terrorist organization in existence. You know, like nobody else.
Yeah.
Like G.I. Joe does not concern itself with anybody else.
Yeah.
And in X-Men, there are other villains, but by and large, it's Magneto and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants that keep coming back and are the recurring villains. And it even reads, the way that it's structured to me, it even reads like cartoons in the 80s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm kind of projecting stuff on it, but I really felt like its structure and the episodic nature of it with these recurring villains. Yeah, it really felt like that.
Huh.
Which was really interesting.
Hey, Leah, did you ever read any of the original, like, Silver Age X-Men? Did you ever pick any of those up?
I went back and read select stories. My memory is getting muddled at this point because I read about stories as well, so I'm having a hard time remembering which stories I read and which stories I read about, which is kind of funny, but but no, I went back and I read a lot of the origins of all the characters, and the I did not read all those Silver Age ones, so the episodic aspect of like the reoccurring villain of Magneto, I did not, that's not something that I remember. But one thing that I do remember that I thought was interesting, Corey, you touched on this, is Magneto has changed a lot over the years, because he has become this character that, like, they try and make, you know, the he's trying to, like, liberate the mutants, and they make all the parallels with the Nazis and the that he was in the death camps and all that, but they gloss over the fact that he straight up killed like thousands or probably hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, he tried to, in the first issue, he tries to launch a nuclear weapon, right, Corey?
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, he's not playing around. Right.
No, but that's the thing. Later on, too, if you jump forward, I mean, we're talking of the older stuff, but if you jump forward, that whole thing where he made the asteroid,
Asteroid M.
Yeah, and he launched an EMP on the entire planet that, like, crippled all electrical functions of everything, that straight up would have killed like hundreds of thousands of people. All the people in the hospitals, all the airplanes, they just totally gloss over that.
Well, that's the thing, is like, okay, so like Magneto eventually tries to reform at one point, and obviously this may be even beyond like where you've been reading, Corey, but I mean, there's so many things. I think you got to the point, am I correct, Corey, where you got to the point where he sinks like a Russian sub or something?
Yeah, I just read 158 yesterday, and so in 150, yeah, he sinks a Russian submarine.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning, actually. Chris Claremont had started to lay the groundwork of making him a little bit more of a sympathetic character, and that issue, you know, he does that really terrible act, and then by the end of it, he accidentally injures, well, he doesn't accidentally, he intentionally attacks Kitty Pryde, but she's new to him, he doesn't know who she is, and then he discovers that she's a kid, she's a little girl, and he kind of has a breakdown and realizes, like, I've become this monster, and we've already established previously that he had a daughter, and so, you know, Kitty Pryde probably reminds him of his daughter and who died and in the concentration camps, like you mentioned, and so that's the beginning of turning him around. And as I understand, because Leah, like you, I've read a lot of summaries of stories, and so I know that he becomes the headmaster for a while, and he's leading it. You know, like he really becomes like essentially a good guy for quite a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God, you just reminded me. That's the first X-Men book I read. It's a book where Magneto is the headmaster. And this is when Storm has her mohawk.
Yeah.
And they're doing this practice in the, you know, in the danger room, and they're and I cannot remember the issue exactly, but it's with Mojo, and I think they all get shrunk down and become kids at one point.
Oh, yeah. That's really, yeah. They did like, yeah, that's the thing with the X-Men, is that it was always the book that was, at least when I was a teenager and like growing up and reading them, they were very much, they weren't Spider-Man, they weren't Captain America, they weren't the Avengers, they weren't like Justice League or Super, they were like this book that was like on the fringe, and they were always doing like really weird, interesting things, you know, and sometimes if you hadn't read a couple of issues and you pick something up, you would be like, what the hell is this? Like, I don't even know what's going on, you know, but it's interesting, you know, and the thing that the X-Men always had going for it was somehow they always managed to get the best artists on those books, like, or at least the most interesting at the time and very dynamic. You know, you had like John Byrne and Cockrum, right? And you had Neil Adams at one point. You had, you know, Mark Silvestri, I remember being a big deal. John Romita Jr., Paul Smith, Jim Lee, you know, like all these like amazing artists through the years, which really kind of, at least for somebody like me, helped keep me interested in the book. As much as I love the stories, the artwork was always super solid. But, you know, and that's the thing, like, as far as, like, Magneto's concerned, you know, you had Wolverine, who, honestly, he should have been a bad guy, you know, at least kind of like when he was first introduced, right?
He was he was.
Yeah, well, with the Hulk, right?
Yeah.
But he was kind of like an agent. He was like an enemy of the Hulk, but I don't think he was a bad guy. He was like a Canadian, like, secret agent.
I thought he was an assassin or a mercenary that was, like, sent to kill the Hulk.
I think he was sent to track him down by Canada. I don't think I've ever read that first Hulk issue. I got to track it down if I can. But
I did. Actually, that was one of the ones I read too in that period of, you know, no actual X-Men stories. So I read that, and he is sent by the government. So he's like, it's definitely like a government agent. But I think they do say, you know, get rid of Hulk and Wendigo. Like, his mission is to take them both down.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, both right, basically.
But you basically sort of had like he was a psycho when he was first, like, he was kind of like the short fuse who you were afraid would, like, gut somebody. Like,
yeah, I mean, on earlier missions of the X-Men, he is killing guards and things like that. And,
yeah.
And the other team members are like, what are you doing?
But my point is that you had, like, as the book went on, particularly I think when Chris Claremont came on, you definitely had sort of multifaceted aspects of these characters that emerged, right, that probably didn't exist before Claremont's run. Is that correct, Corey, or am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think he... I might credit John Byrne more for Wolverine's sort of deepening of his character, just because he changed a little bit during Dave Cockrum's run with Chris Claremont, but once John Byrne arrived, it seemed like he really became more of an interesting character. And it's what's interesting is I'm reading up to the point where John Byrne has left and Dave Cockrum has come back, and Wolverine has really fallen back into the background.
Interesting.
So it really does seem like John Byrne was pushing that character's prominence when he was around, and finding ways to make the character more interesting and not just sort of a simplistic, you know, I'm angry, I have claws, you know, like, you know, finding, you know, ties to Japan and Japanese culture and making him more a member of the team. Like, he was really kind of the outsider of the team, and he really started to befriend them and respect them, and they respecting him more.
Yeah.
By the end of John Byrne's run.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to note that character, you know, I mean, Wolverine kind of became the superstar of the X-Men. You know, he kind of somehow along the line, he just, like, clicked with readers. And I don't know if that was the Frank Miller miniseries, you know, that was done that kind of helped push him become. But do you think that John Byrne, because I remember that especially during the Dark Phoenix run, like, he definitely jumped to the forefront a lot, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the whole Hellfire confrontation, Hellfire Club confrontation.
Yeah.
He's on his own. And
that awesome panel where he's like, now it's my turn, and he's in
the sewers.
Yeah.
And his, you know, his quoting of the sort of the riff on the famous quote, let me ask you a question, or, you know, whatever that whole thing was, from a Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah.
He, it really felt like he, you know, and the Alpha Flight was introduced and resolving hit, kind of John Byrne's seeming, or Chris Claremont as well, but them seeming to want to go back and address, well, Wolverine just walked out on the Canadian government, so they probably want him to kind of answer for that. And, you know, so there's all these loose threads that they're starting to explore, revealing his name and that being a big deal, you know, and, like, nobody else had this sort of enigma to them like Wolverine did on that team.
Yeah. I mean, it must be interesting, because now it's like I almost want to follow in your footsteps. I have these, like, two gigantic X-Men omnibuses, but maybe I need to sign up for that app, because it must be really fascinating, especially reading your, like, synopses on your Facebook page, just seeing how much stuff changes. Like, I know the one thing that everyone loves to go back to is how, like, Professor X had a crush on like Jean Grey. Like when the and it's like, wow, that's just like ultra creepy, you know?
Yeah. He that was, and Professor X, actually, speaking of the characters evolving, like Magneto, Professor X was, I mean, he was straight up manipulate, like telepathically manipulating people and wiping memories and just being like totally invasive. Like, you know, there's a, I remember one scene where Iceman's having this like private thought, and then Professor X just barges in and is like, "I heard you, and you know, that's 3 demerit points."
Wow, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, no, you know, total invasion of privacy, total manipulating people's lives, their memories, forcing people to do things. You know, it's he had very little ethics, and but then he, it's interesting because I always thought that it was one of those things where let's just forget about that and pretend that never happened, but Chris Claremont did sort of address it and have him start to say like, I'm not really doing that anymore, and you know, he kind of backpedals. It's interesting, like Professor X is a more one less likable but more complicated character than he is portrayed, especially when I was reading in the 90s and later. He was really this sort of saintly figure almost, and it's not quite that simple. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes he's really kindly and parental, and then other times it's like he's just like a straight up dick. Like, it's like, yeah. I don't like, where, what is this guy doing, or where is he coming from? And I think during the 80s was, there was a period when I was reading where he sort of regained his ability to walk or something. Can't remember how. Like, maybe there was some kind of Shi'ar cloning.
I think
cloning.
They cloned him a new body.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think the Shi'ar may have, like, cloned him and transplanted his brain or something. Some weird comic book stuff. But, you know, it's interesting that that we note that these characters, I think probably more than any other comic book, have evolved over the years. You know, I mean, you talk about Magneto and you talk about, you know, Professor X and Wolverine, like all of them have grown and changed and sort of, you know, developed so much throughout the years. Right, Corey? I mean,
yeah, I think because they were this tertiary book for up until the early 80s, where suddenly I think Marvel's kind of upper management were like, whoa, this sales are really good here. They got away with a lot of stuff, and they could just do their own thing without editors stepping in and be like, wait a minute, we have an action figure to sell.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean, even the new X-Men from the, you know, the mid-70s, the all new, all different X-Men, they had an opportunity to grow too. Like, you know, like we talked about with Wolverine, where he's this, you know, sort of like, you know, kind of a one-note character really, and then then evolves, and then, and Storm evolving from this sort of goddess character and really turning into the team leader and embracing that, and really having this maternal relationship with Kitty Pryde when Kitty Pryde's introduced, which I never knew about, actually. I never knew their relationship was so strong. Banshee being written out of the book, I think, was the greatest benefit to the mankind that I could.
Why do you say that? Well, Sunfire and Banshee, and then Thunderbird gets killed in that first like arc, right?
Or yeah, I mean, I think right? From what I understand, Sunfire was never going to be a member. He was always meant to just kind of be in that first big story, and then Thunderbird, I understand, was always meant to be killed off. But Banshee was a member for a while. But yeah, I he was really annoying.
was he just like, was it because he's like sort of like a stereotype of like?
Yeah, I mean, I think the accent overplayed, and he's a little bit older than the other characters, so he doesn't really fit in. And so he doesn't really gel with the team.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's something about the way he's played that was kind of like, when he was written out, it was like, okay, good.
Yeah.
And,
Well, what's really interesting too about the X-Men has always been sort of, I don't know if it's like a feminist slant or how much they seem to appeal to women or like teenage girls, because whenever I would sort of like date a girl like late high school or early college, and they found out I read comic books, like one of the ones that they always seemed to be drawn to was the X-Men. You know what I mean? And even after we would break up or whatever, they would kind of be like, oh yeah, I'm still checking out that X-Men stuff, you know? And it's like, really? And that's like one of the great things that Claremont was good at doing. He was really good at developing and growing, you know, Storm, you had like Mystique, you had Rogue eventually, you had all these female characters that were very strong, very vulnerable, and like they weren't like put in the back seat, you know? I think at one point there were even more female X-Men than there were male X-Men in some of the books.
Yeah, I mean, even Moira McTaggart, who's really sort of a supporting character, but her first appearance, she like kicks the door down and shows up with a machine gun and just shoots this demon. and, you know, and she's introduced as this sort of like almost a maid character. Like it's not, she's not even revealed as a scientist yet. She's just seen as like somebody that's being brought in to sort of help with stuff. And then she kicks the door down, and you know, and Kitty Pryde, who's really introduced as this, you know, she's like 14 years old, she's this little girl, but she has this basically solo issue where, again, which actually is interesting, the same similar demon from that Moira McTaggart scene, another one of those attacks the mansion, and Kitty Pryde's the only one that is there, and she ends up defeating this demon who really outclasses and outpowers her, but she finds her way. So
that's a great issue. That's a John Byrne issue, right?
I think that was his final issue. And so, you're absolutely right. It's you know, and Storm, of course, is, you know, who becomes a leader and is a very strong personality and is shown as the only one who can get Wolverine to back down. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. It's interesting because at the same time, you would see the male characters have a lot of respect for the female characters. Like they weren't, you know, it's very weird because also this at the same time, especially like say during the 90s, you had the way that the women were drawn, like directly contrasted with the way they were sort of being portrayed. So you had to have like the huge boobs and the tiny waist and the, you know, all that stuff, I guess, for boys to be interested in a way. But at the same time, you had them, it's really interesting because it's almost like the visuals would trick like teenage boys into reading literature that was respectable towards women. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a really interesting way to put it. Because you're right. It's like the visuals are totally just, you know, bordering on, you know,
pornography.
Pornography. I can't remember how to pronounce it, but anyway, basically pornography. And but yeah, you're right. But the way, especially Chris Claremont really established that as a tradition of the book, that the female characters are strong. They full agency. They don't need men. They're fully rounded characters, or at least as much as possible. You know, when possible.
Yeah. And also powerful as far as powers go. I mean, Jean Grey's goes from being one of the, as Marvel Girl, one of the least powerful, to being the Phoenix and the most powerful. And you have Storm, who is practically a goddess to some, you know, in her country, and has like crazy powers. And even Kitty Pryde, who has like such the powers of like not being there almost, but she ends up being very, very powerful and using her powers in very unique ways.
Yeah,
it's a very passive power, but it allows her to do things that others can't do.
Well, and there's also the really big, like the X-Men was another book that I think more so than maybe even Spider-Man was another book that sort of embraced the soap opera aspect of stuff, right? Like all the romances and the relationships. And obviously, like, I remember Rogue being sort of like one of my favorites, and she you know, just wanted to experience love, but she couldn't touch anyone, you know what I mean? And then you had the romance with like Scott Summers. Is it Sumner or Summers? Summers, right? Yeah. Summers and Jean Grey, which is something that I don't think was there in the beginning of the book, but as the book went on, it just became sort of one of the great sort of romance or like tortured romance tales of comic history, right?
Yeah, that was one of the things that really interested me was, you know, in her first appearance, everybody just goes gaga over her, except for Iceman, because he, you know, because he's the youngest. Presumably.
And gay, apparently, now.
Yeah, retroactively gay. But, yeah, but at the time, I think the intention was to use the youngest.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just kidding.
But you're right.
Just interesting. Another development that how things change over the years.
Yeah. But a few issues later, he also is chasing her, you know, probably because he, it's like when you see your older brothers, which is probably how he thought of them. It's like, oh, that's how you interact with girls now. Oh, okay. You know?
Yeah.
As we were saying earlier, even Professor X, it's like Jean Grey was apparently the most beautiful living female on the planet.
Well, they were all trapped at that school, Corey. There was nowhere else to go.
Pickings was slim. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but in the beginning, Scott did pine for her, like the others did, but he was the only one who didn't actively chase her because of his paranoia over his powers. He felt like his eye blast would, you know, destroy people he loved, and so, you know, he felt tortured from that. And so what developed was really interesting was a triangle between Angel, Cyclops, and Jean Grey. And that really was like a recurring, that was like, they really played that for a while.
Oh, really?
And then what's interesting to me was that Angel, I always had a hard time getting a personality from him.
He was always the most boring one.
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely.
But in these earlier issues, he's almost the Wolverine of the book. Like he's the impulsive one. He's the one that will, a little bit arrogant because he can fly, I guess. Even though what typically resulted was that he was the first one to screw up. And so he kind of, you know, I think probably inadvertently gets this impression that he's kind of like the most ineffectual character of the whole book. But it's interesting that he's going after Jean too, but he is this, you know, he's essentially the playboy of the team.
Yeah.
He's a good looking rich kid. And so he and Jean actually kind of go out sometimes, but Jean is secretly pining after Scott as well. And so it's kind of interesting. It's like she's with Angel sort of, but really wants to be with Scott, but Scott doesn't say anything. So she assumes Scott doesn't like him. And
teenage romance.
Yeah. So that soap opera element that you talk about, which Chris Claremont really brought to the fore and really made, you know, at times the A story versus kind of this subplot thing.
Absolutely.
But it is kind of in the DNA of the book, which Stan and Jack established because of that threesome, or that, no, well, not threesome. Maybe they would have liked that, but the, you know,
the love triangle.
Thank you. Yeah. So, and in fact, at one point, the whole love thing is such an element of the book that every character has a girlfriend or boyfriend.
Yeah.
Like eventually Scott and Jean do end up dating in those pre-Claremont era. Angel starts dating Candy Southern. Beast dates I forget her name, Vera or somebody like that, and then Bobby is dating a girl, and so they all have a girlfriend. You know, it's like, you know, so that piece of it is there,
from the beginning,
but definitely as it goes. Particularly once Roy Thomas takes over the book, he it's almost like he has this concerted effort of wrapping up the triangle and getting everybody their respective boyfriend and girlfriend.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I even remember Wolverine had like sort of an unrequited love for a while there, and like he meets, I think, is it Mariko or Marie?
Yeah,
and he's like, she would never look at me. I'm an animal. It's just like, right. Oh my god.
Doesn't he get married at one point with someone?
Yeah, he marries her.
Yeah,
actually.
He marries her eventually. Yeah, but in the beginning, it's very much like those thought bubbles where it's like, I'm Wolverine. She would never look at me. She would never, and she's like this very sort of reserved sort of Japanese, you know, ancestral family woman, and she would never approach him. It just wouldn't be appropriate. And I don't think it's up until that Frank Miller Wolverine miniseries that sort of kind of like, because then there's like the Silver Samurai, and there's like, you can't be in love with him because he's not Japanese or something like that. I can't remember.
Well, they meet earlier on, they meet earlier on when they go to Japan and they have another, they meet up with Sunfire again, and then he's somehow connected with her family. And so that's when they first meet and they kind of, you know, have little doe eyes at each other. And and then the X-Men return to New York, and then big coincidence, suddenly Mariko's in New York. And they just happen to walk past each other, yeah, in New York City, you know. And so then they are shown to be sort of hanging out, like it's definitely they're dating. And then she, where I'm reading right now, like she hasn't been mentioned for a while.
Yeah.
So
well, that was one of the things. Like it was really interesting because now we can get to, as the book went on, especially when Claremont came on, there would be introductions of things, and then they would either just take like years to resolve, or they just wouldn't get resolved. Like, and it's interesting because the X-Men, can you imagine like saying to somebody like, hey, the X-Men just used to be one book. Like there was just one X-Men book. Like that's all it was. It was Uncanny X-Men. It may not even, was it always Uncanny X-Men or it was?
It was originally, X-Men, and then X-Men. They added
Uncanny X-Men.
The Uncanny, actually, in the second part of the Days of Future Past is when they officially became Uncanny.
Oh, Uncanny X-Men. And then there was only one book, and it was, like, really tight. It was, like, a tight sort of, like, little mini universe within the Marvel, continuity. And that was kind of what was always great about the X-Men, too, right, is that it sort of seemed to be its own little thing inside the larger scope of the Marvel universe, like that it was very sort of separate and its own and kind of special. And then you sort of get to late 80s and 90s where, you know, and there's a, I think there's a great Chris Claremont documentary from this organization called the Sequart organization. It's sequart.org. That's Sequart. .org, and they have a documentary about Chris Claremont's X-Men. But I think at some point, you're right, Corey, you said earlier, Marvel starts noticing, hey, this thing is selling like hotcakes, and what's his name, the editor, what's that guy's name, the Jim Shooter, basically is like, we got to do another book. And I think the first one is The New Mutants, right?
Yes.
And yeah, that's when things sort of start to splinter off and go crazy a little bit, right?
Yeah, and apparently he Chris Claremont, you know, really had grown to have a lot of ownership over these characters. And so when the idea of the spinoff started being brought up, he's like, well, he initially didn't want them, but when it was clear it was going to happen whether he wanted it or not, he's like, well, okay, I'll write it. And then, you know, he just got stretched too thin. And then that's, I think, where you really start seeing plots that are just kind of like, you know, picked up and dropped or, you know, hanging forever and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I remember there's something with Rachel Summers, like the alternate future sort of daughter version.
She's the daughter of, she's the future daughter of Jean Grey that comes back, you know, from the future to the present.
Yeah.
But they never have a daughter.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. That's obviously the thing that happens. But I just remember she shows up, and there's one particular issue where I was saying this to you, Corey, when we were messaging back and forth. There's one specific issue because they have Rachel is like being pursued by the Black Queen. I think, what was her name again? Celine or something like that?
Yeah.
And she's being hunted. And Rachel actually, like, at the end of the issue, she kind of, like, disappears. And then they just, I can't remember. I'd have to go back and look at it. But I remember it's one of those things that just, like, never got resolved. Like, she just, like, disappeared. And, like, issue after issue after issue, thinking, like, what's going on? Like, is she, what's happening? And she eventually shows up in the pages of Excalibur or something. But there's like no real explanation initially. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, something's wrong here. Like, it seemed like they were going to address something and they didn't. And that would happen a lot, like, as the books went on, like into the 90s and stuff. Like, where there would be a storyline or something introduced and it would just disappear. And you would be like, what the heck just happened? You know? And then you had like four or five books, like X-Force, New Mutants, and then miniseries upon miniseries, and it just became too much.
Yeah, I actually just read an issue with Mystique and Carol Danvers, and there's a little, you know, asterisk over after some dialogue, and then in the bottom, you know, basically Carol Danvers is saying, you know, I don't know why Mystique hates me so much, and Carol Danvers has lost her memory, so she has no idea, you know, really about much of anything, and so she's like, I don't know why Mystique hates me so much, and then there's a little thing, a little asterisk, and then in the bottom it says, see upcoming issue of Marvel Fanfare, and I looked it up, apparently it never.
Oh, really? They referenced something and they didn't finish it?
Wow. Yeah, it was like, reference see, something in the future that never came.
Yeah. Be sure to pick up an issue, an unknown issue of something that'll never happen.
Oh, my God. Wow.
I guess the story was eventually finally finished, but not until like 1992. And this is like 1981 that I'm reading these stories. 82. It's like literally 10 years later. It's like, oh, yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, things were like the train kind of went off the rails, and but I still kept reading. I mean, I read the X-Men. My last issue of the X-Men, I remember, or at least my last regular issue. I probably would pick them up or pick up a trade here and there just to see like what was going on, because I loved them so much. Like, the X-Men was like an addiction for me for like a long time. I mean, yeah. I didn't follow, you know, I didn't have like tons of money all the time, so I wasn't picking up like X-Force and all that stuff, and you know, but I was in it through like Fall of the Mutants and Mutant Massacre, and what was the one where like there was like an alternate universe, Age of Apocalypse, like I went through all that stuff.
That was a good
I stuck with it forever and ever, and I knew that it was getting like bad, like I was like I or that I just couldn't keep up, like there was stuff that but I like the moment where I was like I'm done with you, like where it was like an abusive spouse relationship to me, or I was like was the moment where Magneto, well there were two things, first of all it gets revealed that Magneto never really kind of reformed on his own, that it was always like Professor X had like done something to his brain, and that's why he reformed. And it was, and Magneto found out, and Magneto was pissed. He was like, "How dare you!" Blah blah blah. And I was just so mad at that. I was like, "Professor X would never do that." Obviously now, Corey, you're talking about, yeah, maybe he would, you know. But I remember at the time I was like, "That would never happen." Blah blah blah. And then as a result of that, Magneto goes buck wild and crazy. And he extracts the adamantium from Wolverine's bones. And I remember being, this is so nerdy, I remember being such a nerd and being like, adamantium is non-magnetic. There is no way that Magneto could, because that's why the explanation was like, well, why doesn't Magneto just take Wolverine over or take over Captain America's shield? And like, you know, magnetically just like to see, because adamantium is non-magnetic. That's one of its properties. But and I just remember being so pissed, and I was like, that's it. I'm done. I'm done with you. I'm never reading this again. I'm so tired of all the crossovers. But at the same time, like I said, I would go back every once in a while because a love of the X-Men had been fostered for a long time.
Well, two things. So, there's an early issue of Wolverine. I just remember the cover, especially. I think it's the first time the new X-Men fight Magneto, and he does control there's a shot of a panel of Wolverine holding his own forearm away, pushing it away from him as his claws are coming closer to his face. So. I don't know, you know, maybe they change, you know, of course.
Maybe I missed
change.
That. Like, yeah, oh. Of course.
Yeah, but, you know, details, of course, are it's funny how those little things, like, you know, originally Wolverine's claws were on his gloves, you know, so.
Yeah.
Changed. But I at one point, I mean, just I totally relate to what you're saying, where I mean, I was so, like, I was getting every spinoff book, like, for a while.
Wow.
Like, I think about it, and I, like, if I had kept my allowance money rather than buying, you know.
Oh, don't even get me started down that road, because I will blow my head off if I think about that.
Like, you know, Kazar, you know, like that's how far out I was going.
Yeah.
Like, well, it's X-Men related, because your first appearance is X-Men.
He's X-Men related to the Savage Land. That was actually a good book. That's like one of the Kubert brothers drew that, right?
Yeah, you're right, actually.
I loved his art on that. Yeah.
but yeah, I mean, I was getting X-Force, X-Factor, Excalibur, Uncanny X-Men, X-Men Unlimited, the quarterly book, Generation X.
Did you collect X-Man? Wow. I collected X-Man.
Oh, X-Man?
I loved X-Man.
Did you really?
Yeah.
That was a good book too.
Crazy until he became like the guardian messiah thing. But up until that point, that's when it petered off and ended. But up until that point, I loved that book.
I tried to. It's really funny because, as you guys know, over the summer I reorganized like my remaining comic book collection, which isn't as huge as it used to be. But I came across some X-Man issues, and I was like, man, I'd like to track these down. And I look every time I type in X-Man on eBay, it comes up X-Men. It's infuriating. They retype it. They won't let me type X-Man. And I'm like, no, I'm looking for X-Man. I want X-Man. It's so funny. Yeah, they even had a book called X-Man.
Equivalent of Cable from Age of Apocalypse.
Okay.
But without the virus thing eating.
Oh my god! Like I don't even know anything about Cable. Like I just like was so done. Like at what point, Corey? At what point did they like? When were you done with it? When were you just like, I have to stop? Because that's what it was like. It was like, I have to stop because yeah. I'm not going to be able to read Spider-Man or Superman or Batman. I'm just going to be reading all these X-Men books, you know?
Yeah, I think I was... Well, when I stopped, there was a lot of creative shuffling going on. Like, it was... Who was it?
This is after
I think
Claremont.
Joe Harris.
Okay.
Yeah, way after Claremont. And you know, it was like Joe Harris and... I think it was him and maybe one other guy, but they came on and it was like new beginning. Like it was like, you know, this creative rejuvenation, it seemed, and they went like three issues and then they were out and it was somebody else. And it was like, okay. And so I started to kind of, and by then I had already started like trimming the fat. Like I was like, okay, no more. Like I'm only getting the ones that I actually like into.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
but
I stopped getting Wolverine. And
you would be like, I don't know what's going on. Like,
yeah, because then there was a crossover with those books that I just dropped, so I have to go get them again. And so, yeah, so then I think at that point, I don't remember the issue, but it was at that point where, like, it felt like there was, like, okay, we're kind of, like, grabbing the reins here, and it's going to be good again. And then it was like, okay, now we're grabbing the reins again. And, it, you know, like, it just felt like they kept like, okay, this is the now we're going to be really good. And it was, forget it.
Kind of
so
like what
stopped.
DC's doing right now. Like,
yeah,
like revamping their universe. What about you, Liad? Were you like seriously into X-Men, or were you just picking them up every once in a while?
Well, I was seriously into it, but at the time, in the beginning, when I was like a teenager, all I could do was order them like a subscription. I couldn't pick up the all the books around it because I could only have like up to six subscriptions was my max. And so I had Spider-Man and I had a few other things, but then I'd pick up trades to catch up every once in a while. But I stopped reading when Grant Morrison came on. And
oh, really?
Oh, he just killed it for me.
Really? Because I like that stuff.
Oh, no. When he turned it into the new X-Men and everyone started wearing leather and the artist Quietly came on. Yeah, that was it for me. That was when I was out. I couldn't take that anymore.
that whole era is really interesting because seems like Liad, I think is classic where if you were already reading the book and then it became Grant Morrison's run, most people hated it. Like I know plenty of people just like that where they were reading it and they were, you know, and then this sudden like what the. But if you were like Christian and me who had already given up on it and then came back to it, most of those people loved it.
Yeah, that's really funny because you're absolutely right. Because I remember hearing that Grant Morrison, and unlike Liad, I really like Frank Quietly's art. But I remember picking up those issues, and then quietly, that was the other thing, quietly kind of like dropped off like halfway through, or he couldn't keep up. And they had another artist who really got the shaft, who was a decent artist, but he was so rushed that the pages never looked good because he was brought in at the last minute. And I think that art, I can't remember his name. It's like Alexandro something. I can't remember his name. It's something like Eastern European. But I remember like hearing like that really affected his comic book career because he was brought in at the last minute and he was like, X-Men, yeah. And then the pages weren't coming out as good as, you know, he wanted them to. And a lot of fans trashed him. But I remember picking up those issues, like hearing about it and liking Frank Quietly's art. And, you know, obviously Grant Morrison was like a big name and thinking like, this is exactly what this book needed. Like it needed a drastic shift. That's so funny.
I couldn't take it. No, that it was just, there wasn't, it was just, I don't know. I thought it was just really bad. And the writing, Grant Morrison tends to, at least when he does like superhero stuff, there's a lot of like shock and awe to his writing.
Yeah, sure.
Which I can't stand because it just feels like the stuff is just brought in from nowhere. It has nothing to do with anything. It's just, let's just do this because it's messed up, and let's just do this because it'll shock you, and let's just do this. And then none of it matters anyways because they're just going to undo it all anyways. But I mean, yeah. I mean, what's it, in his run, Xavier, he, as a infant, not even an infant, still in his mother's womb, kills his sister because she, with the umbilical cord, because she's evil. I mean, what the?
I can't like, remember really? That. Yeah. I blacked all that out. Sure.
Come on, come on. We've all been there.
I just remember Zorn,
but then Zorn
was cool.
Stays in his head as a. As an entity and grows with him and then comes. I mean, what?
Oh, I kind of remember this now. Yeah. That was kind of crazy. Yeah. This is like, that's an understatement. What I remember was liking Zorn, being like, wow, this is a crazy character. Like, I just remember thinking at the time, like, and not to dive way too much into Grant Morrison's X-Men, but I just remember thinking like X-Men was always like the weird quirky book, and he was kind of getting it back to that in a way. And but I also remember the big explosion that occurred when the rumor got out that Zorn was actually Magneto.
And
like,
how
people
disappointing
freaking
was
out
that?
Yeah, people were like freaking out, and then Marvel at the last minute was like, oh my god, it got out. And then they were trying to like say to fans like, no, it that's not what it is, and then it ended up being exactly what it is, and people like being like, fans being like really angry. And I remember walking into the comic shop and somebody telling me like, oh yeah, Zorn is Magneto, and I'm like, really? Like, it's just like,
I know, okay. How disappointing was that?
But that's the thing. I you know, it's been so long, and that's actually one of those things that I came across in my comic collection that I still have, and I'm like, oh, I want to go back and reread this at some point.
The end of that run was really interesting too, because I really got the sense that even Marvel had sort of gotten cold feet, like when they first had him start the book, they're like, yeah, just go crazy, just be insane, do whatever.
Yeah.
And then by the end of the run, it seemed like they were getting such flack from a contingent of fans that they were like, actually it wasn't Magneto, you know, after he was gone.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And there was, like, as I read those issues, then I read the issues immediately after it, and there was I think they had Chuck Austin or somebody, and there was all this backpedaling of like, actually, wasn't Magneto, and,
yeah.
You know,
that nothing he did meant anything. I mean, he turned Beast gay, that didn't stick. He did all kinds of changes, and then they just retconned everything.
I think
you can't blame him for
I think that this is what we're getting into, is that the X-Men, particularly the X-Men, I think, were one of the comics, because they grew so like unwildly, you know what I mean? Like, it got so out of control. There were so many books. Nobody seemed to be directing the ship, that it really sort of became indicative of kind of what was wrong with comics, like in the 90s and a little bit beyond, right? Where it became like crossovers and you know, and special events and lenticular covers and like the X-Men, all those X books after a while and stuff not sticking and retrofitting and alternate realities, like that, a lot of that stuff comes from the X-Men, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and
yeah, I think it really became too, like we were saying earlier, where management started to pay attention to it and started to drive it more. And that, you know, I think that really brought about, I don't know if the X-Men in particular brought it about, but it certainly was a poster child for this kind of age of the editor, where the editor's really driving the book and then the writer's just sort of like filling in the word balloons, you know, and then probably getting rewritten anyway, as though they hadn't written it to begin with.
So,
I mean, there was definitely in the 90s and early 2000s, this kind of over management and marketing driven books.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you would call that. Like, is that irony that it started off as this book that almost got canceled, that nobody cared about, that Neil Adams could sneak on and be like, I'm going to do some crazy stuff here and kind of like do one of the most impressive runs when he was on it. And then Chris Claremont comes along. And then, you know, so for years and years, you have like these really interesting, you know, comics that definitely changed the way people read and wrote them. And then it just grew so bloated down the years that it became sort of like the poster child, like you said, like of kind of what was wrong with the industry, you know what I mean? And it's kind of sad in a way, but at the same time, there's still like people like me who, I mean, I've got a statue of Wolverine and Cyclops on my desk, you know what I mean?
Kissing.
Like, yes, exactly. They should have always been lovers. It was Jean Grey was always their distraction. That's why they hated each other.
It was just like
Jean is getting in my way of Scott. Scott is getting in. Yeah, you could have somebody just go in and Photoshop those balloons. I'm not giving you ideas, but yeah, redo those old X-Men balloons. But yeah, I mean,
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously the affection for those characters is absolutely still there because of that amazing foundation, and then and so, you know, like when we're talking about the end of Grant Morrison's run and then how they sort of like were backpedaling, and then I think when they brought in Joss Whedon and John Cassaday, where they really, that was really an embracing of a classic era, and it was a wonderful run. And so it was almost like they were trying to be like, okay, we got a little too weird there, let's pull it back, but also reinvigorate some of that charm that it used to have. So it can still happen, obviously, you know, and I think even some newer stuff, I mean, Brian Michael Bendis gets a lot of flack, but from what I understand, some of the stuff actually is good. Like, if you actually read it, it's actually, some of the stuff he's doing is supposedly good. I haven't read it.
Yeah, I've been hearing good things about him, about his run on X-Men 2. I just wasn't a big fan of his Avengers stuff and his writing style in general, but it seems to me like word on the street is that his style has sort of grown a little bit, and maybe he's embraced more of the comic book, you know what I mean? Like the superhero, where it seemed like a lot of those guys when they first came onto Marvel were like, ugh, no costumes, ugh, you know, none of this, like no word balloons, blah, 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 you know, and it seems like maybe they've come around a little bit. But so I don't know, Corey, what, like, to wrap this up, you know, because God knows, there's how many years of X-Men? 50 years? 60 years at this point?
Yes, started in 63, so...
More than 50 years. Like, so what is... And there's no way we're going to touch on everything in the short time that we have. Maybe we can come back to, you know, X-Men later. But what... Okay, so let's all answer this question. What was your favorite issue or arc of the X-Men? And who is your favorite X-Man? It's a toughie. I know who
it is. A toughie.
Well, if you know yours, why don't you start?
My favorite X-Man, and people are going to hate me for this, they're going to be like, what? I love Cyclops. I just love Cyclops. I don't know why. I've always loved the tortured, romantic sort of like burden of responsibility, you know, character that he is, and how he kind of like isn't the flashiest, you know what I mean? And but he is Mr. X-Man. Like, you can't, like, I don't think you can have the X-Men without Cyclops, you know what I mean? Even more so than like Professor X. Like, he's the guy that became the leader of Mantleship, like originally when Professor X left. And I know that Storm stepped in after a while and, you know, he left the group, but he was always, even back then, he was like, every time I get out, they just pull me back in. You know, like he can't leave. He was raised an X-Man, you know, he was raised, right. You know, on the mansion. And I just love Cyclops. And my favorite issue, quite frankly, is that Paul Smith issue where that introduced me to the X-Men, because it's the issue that shows that Cyclops, if he wants to be, can be a badass. Like, everyone's always like, oh, he's just got these eye beams and he can't. Yeah, but he's got the brain, you know what I mean? Like, he's a tactician. There's a reason why he was a leader for a while. So everyone always discounts Cyclops and is like, oh, he's boring. Like, I love Cyclops. I just love him. I think he's great. So there you go. Screw you, Wolverine.
And what about your favorite, what was it? Favorite run or artist? What was it?
Well, no, it was definitely that Paul Smith, Paul Smith run. I mean, if we're talking about arcs, like that one issue where it's Mastermind trying to convince the X-Men that Jean Grey has been, you know, resurrected, and he has to fight his way through the mansion and stuff like that. That's like my single favorite X-Men issue, I think. But like, if we're talking about arcs, it's like the Dark Phoenix saga all the way. I know it's like a pat answer or whatever, but again, that was the one where I was like, damn, this is hardcore. Like, these are these characters are great. And it also introduced me to what was my favorite artist for a long time, was John Byrne. So, you know, what can you do? But any answers on your end? There's got to be something.
No, definitely. For me, I always loved the Age of Apocalypse run.
Oh, wow.
That whole story. Because I don't know why. It's just that playing with the characters, and you get to see their personalities, you know, come through still. Yeah. And
it's
also
like the mirror of the X-Men.
Yeah, and exploring the different aspects of things, characters, other stories. Also probably because of when I grew up and when I happened to read it, you know?
Sure.
So I'm sure that's a big part of it. I'm really torn as to who's my favorite X-Man, like, or X-Men character.
Sure.
I mean, it really, like, it's definitely not Wolverine. He's actually kind of annoying at this point. I think it really, I mean, honestly, it really depends how they're written. I find a lot of characters very interesting, and I wish, like, there's a bunch of characters that I have an affinity for, and I really wish they would be explored or expanded, because they never were to a sufficient, at least, degree. Like, I love Cannonball. Like, I love that character. The idea that this character has the power to, like, not be touched by anything as long as he's moving, and yet is always, like, one of the first knocked out in any fight. And I don't know how that works. Like, I really want to know how this character, you know.
I don't think he's technically an X-Man, Leon. You still haven't answered the question.
No, he actually was.
Did he become an X-Man?
Yeah, he was in the X-Men. He was in the main book.
He's promoted.
Gladiator. One-on-one fight.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah. Okay, I kind of remember this now.
Yeah, so, like, I love that character. I guess maybe of the original, I would say Iceman.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, like, any particular issue that stands out, it's Age of Apocalypse, pretty much, like, that whole arc.
I love that story arc where you get to just see all the, like, yeah, like you said, the mirror stuff, just the craziness. Cool. And the different the characters in a very different way.
Sure.
So.
What about you, Corey? Since you've been reading, this is the answer I'm most interested in, because you've been reading them for like a year. So I want to know, like, what stands out to you so far.
It's difficult because I'm balancing what I've read recently and my, you know, younger, you know, memories of the newer stuff.
Yeah.
Or more recent stuff. So, I mean, I guess my favorite character is Storm. I love her, you know, I just love her. No. I like her strength, like how she's portrayed as very free-spirited, very strong-willed, compassionate, and just her, like, earthiness. And favorite issue. It's difficult. I guess. I'll say for arc favorite arc, I'll say the Days of Future Past. I actually put that over the Phoenix Saga. I think it's tighter, it's more compact and efficient, and I think the writing and the dialoguing is stronger, and it's really a template for so much that comes, like, you know, Age of Apocalypse would never have existed without these two issues, you know, things like that.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which Age of Apocalypse I love too, actually. For a single issue, I probably will go for one of the ones that I read when I was younger, but take place much later. The death of Ileana.
Oh, wow, yeah.
That issue.
Was that the virus or the?
Yeah, they had this thing where there was the legacy virus
for
a while.
The legacy
virus, sort of like
AIDS.
Kind of HIV. AIDS. Yeah. which was always a uncomfortable analogy, but it was you know, all these characters were suddenly like just dying, and it wasn't like a supervillain, it was they just got sick and died. And so Ileana, who had been a superhero in New Mutants, but because she had sort of like been advanced in age, and then she was back to her original age as a little girl, and like a preteen girl, and she had the legacy virus, and Jubilee, who is kind of the sort of the Kitty Pryde of that era, really took to her, and it was just, for me, as I remember, I may, when I get up to it, it may be very heavy-handed and terrible, but as I recall, it was really touching, and there was no superheroics at all, which is something that, you know, I don't know if it's really done anymore, where they have these like down issues, like these issues where it's just no villain, no fighting. It's just the characters interacting.
Yeah.
And that's definitely something Chris Claremont established and was continued for quite a while. And I thought was really a good device because it drew you into the characters closer, so that when you had this big bombastic action scenes and explosions and things, that it, you cared more. It wasn't just like, oh, look at the spectacle. It's, you know, you cared more about the characters involved.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, and for me, that one is like a great template of that type of story.
Well, that's cool. That's awesome. So what issue are you up to? What did you finish up?
I just yesterday read 158, which is kind of like the aftermath of the four-parter that was right before it, of where the Deathbird is introduced. I guess she appeared previously, but in X-Men she's introduced, and she's the sister of Lalandra, who is Professor X's space girlfriend, and I always like to call her. And Lalandra is kidnapped by these unknown terrorists and brought to Earth. So the Shi'ar Empire, you know, loads up their ships and heads over to Earth, thinking that maybe it's the X-Men, and then they find out it's not. They find out it's Deathbird, and they're gonna like just invade Earth. But it's like one of those, we'll give you 24 hours. If you can find Lalandra, we won't invade Earth. and so the X-Men find her and save Earth just in the nick of time.
That's so funny.
And then the next issue is basically, it's almost like a Carol Danvers issue. This 158, and the X-Men are almost like supporting characters. And she, with Storm and Wolverine, they sneak into the Pentagon to erase all of the government's files on the X-Men.
Oh, wow.
Which is cool because it really draws on the long history of the X-Men up to that point. Senator Kelly is doing this TV show, and he's basically saying the mutants are too dangerous, and the X-Men are too dangerous, and we need to you know, do some investigations. And so the X-Men remember that Professor X used to work with an FBI agent named Fred Duncan in the 60s, or the X-Men book 60s, not their 60s.
Yeah.
Marvel contracted time or whatever it's called. And so they remember, like, oh, well, if Professor X used to work with this FBI agent, there must be files on the X-Men. This is dangerous because the government's turning against us, so we need to destroy these files.
Oh, wow.
And so Carol Danvers happens to be hanging out with the X-Men right now, and she is a colonel in the U.S. Air Force. And so she sneaks Wolverine and Storm in. They just happen to run into Storm and Mystique and Rogue. Big fight ensues. Carol Danvers successfully destroys the files, but the X-Men are seen ripping up the Pentagon, and so, you know, their reputation's soured even more.
Oh.
So that's where I am.
Cool. That's awesome. Well, maybe we'll come back when you've read the next 150 issues to 300. That's a lot of X-Men to read.
Yeah, I actually am amazed that I've read as much as I have so far.
That's great. Well, you got to check. Well, I guess I'll have to check out this Marvel app and see how it works. Cool. Well, Corey, keep reading those X-Men. I love reading your updates on Facebook. You should put them on your blog. That's what I keep saying.
Yeah, I should.
Like, you haven't really been doing anything with your blog, but you should definitely put those up on – it's CoreyBlake.com, right?
Yeah, and my Facebook is – when I post those statuses, they're open. Like, anybody could see them.
Oh, that's great.
My blog links to my Facebook page. But that's a good idea. I should post.
And, well, you know, I don't know how open you are with accepting friends, but if you want to see Corey's, you know, updates on the X-Men until he gets them on his blog, check him out on Facebook. And Liad, you are – what's your website again, Liad?
It's Liad.com.
Liad.com. And that's L-E-E-A-H-D, right?
Correct.
Yeah. All right. And this is Christian Horn with Corey Blake and Liad Goldberg. And this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. In the meantime, go and check out this amazing Chris Claremont documentary on sequart.org. And definitely go see Deadpool, but do not bring your children. Please don't bring kids.
Nope.
There was a kid sitting behind me.
Oh, God. No kids. It is definitely not for children. But go see it. It's had a really good opening weekend. And if it, the better the weekend, then, you know, they're already talking about Deadpool 2. But we really want them to have a, you know, good budget, good.
They did a great job with this one.
And yeah, exactly.
Maybe we can all talk about it when more of us see it. So.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
All right. Well, thanks for joining in, and tune in next week for another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Fanboy.com.